Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment. I'm very, very excited. My nipples are tingling. Everything is just absolutely, like, this is great. We've been, what? Okay, shit. I shouldn't have said the nipples thing.
That's okay.
Okay. Should I start over?
No, it's good. It's good.
Okay, all right. So I'm very excited because we have Haris Sultan back, and we're doing a series right now, as you know. We talked about the future of Iran with Armin Navabi. Today we're going to be talking about another place that has changed a lot. And there's a lot of things have changed here in the last like 4 or 5 years. So we're going to talk about Pakistan. That is the homeland for Haris Sultan and for Ali Rizvi. We both come from Pakistan. By the way, you're from Lahore, right? Originally?
Yeah.
You're born in Lahore?
Yeah, born and raised in Lahore. Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
Eddie, can you touch your microphone for a sec?
Touch it here like that? Is that
yeah, okay. Yeah. Maybe get a better quality microphone.
I don't know, it's the same one I use every time.
Yeah, he's using the crappy Apple ones.
Yeah, I'm using the Apple one because the other one I have anyway. So there's a lot that's happened in Pakistan the last few years. It used to be a huge strategic priority for the US at one point. For decades, right? Most notably after 9/11. But now it's not. America's policy is generally drifting towards India, which is, Pakistan doesn't like India, they're enemies. And then there's also a Cold War type thing happening that's growing between the US and China. And China is Pakistan's friend. So, there are all of these other interesting things. The US has accepted that they basically ceded, they fought the longest war of their history in Afghanistan, and now they've pretty much accepted that the Taliban's going to have a dominant influence there. So they're negotiating with them, which is kind of where Imran Khan was a little while ago. There are just so many things happening over there. So I have to ask you something to start, Haris. Do you know that Noam Chomsky, he did an online talk?
Yeah. Right?
With some Pakistani college or university, and they asked him at the end, what Pakistan needs to do. And he said something like, I'm going to find the exact quote, but he said that
Pakistan used to produce world class scientists and all that. And I think he butted them up a bit, but and he said, well, now Pakistan unfortunately is going back, so Pakistan needs to invest more into education, scientific education, and everything. But it's so funny that.
But he specifically called it. He specifically talked about the religious aspect of it. If it clings on to its religious fundamentalism, it's not going to get there. Something like that. I'm going to find it while you talk. But
yeah. So, but it's quite interesting that Noam Chomsky is like. He's so adored, and every Pakistani intellectual loves to bring him up. Why? Because he criticizes U.S. foreign policy. Now all of a sudden on social media, people were like cursing him, like, "Who the hell is this guy? He's just old dude." it's so funny to observe people's biases. I see that with all these Hindu nationalists, and now Bangladeshis have joined in as well.
I have the quote.
Right. So, okay, go for it.
Yeah, so he said specifically, serious scientists who've been trying to preserve a rational educational system which deals with the reality of the world. Okay, then he said, quote, Pakistan has no future if it's going to live in a world of religious superstition. That's what he said. This is in December 2020, just a couple of months ago. So he said it straight up. Yeah.
So it did circulate a lot. And as I said, a lot of Pakistanis were unhappy with him for saying that. But all of a sudden, they just did that, 180 degree turn. It's the same like what just happened with Rihanna, right? She just showed some support for farmers in India. So all the Bhats, the Hindu nationalists, they went after her, and Pakistanis are like, Rihanna, yeah, you know, she's so smart, brilliant, yeah, we're with you, and all that. And one of these guys, I think those who speak Urdu and Hindi, they should follow this guy, Sayed Muzammil. He is one of the mainstream channel's young host, and he makes YouTube videos. I don't know if you've checked him out or not. He actually, he hasn't said anything openly as an atheist. I'm not implying that he's an atheist. But, you know, he puts a portrait of Hitchens sometimes in the background, or sometimes it's Nietzsche. Or, you know, he just puts it up there. And people notice, like, oh, is he an atheist? But anyway, so he's doing wonderful work. And I forgot the point why I brought him up. But yeah, so a lot of these people, a lot of these so-called Pakistani intellectuals, they have been going after Noam Chomsky after they used to quote him. So yeah, I remember now. So he said that all these Pakistanis jumping up and down in support of Rihanna, if she had said the same thing about Balochistan, let's just say, or something about religious fundamentalism in Pakistan, all these ones will throw Rihanna under the bus too. So
Well, they did. Remember when she did the video for Dark Horse and she burned like that Allah thing in there?
Yeah, but it didn't get picked up in Pakistan a lot.
Yeah.
I think that was more so in Arabic world, because there was they playing in the background or something. So a lot of people didn't really pick it up. It's quite remarkable how people just everyone loves blasphemy and criticism if it's for the other person.
So let's start with this, because I actually want to talk about the basis for all of this. So, you know, now what's happening is that obviously, you know, you've got all this stuff happening in India. The US has really warmed up to India. They're building, they're moving their policy towards that. They're building their relationships with them. Pakistan is kind of getting, like, Pakistan got its strongest rebuke for acquitting the murderers of Danny Pearl, right? Of Daniel Pearl, like the Biden administration slammed him. It's kind of, so I want to ask you, since you follow this stuff a lot, the strategic direction of the US, right, under the years of Trump and now under the Biden administration, is Pakistan kind of caught between, okay, the US is warming up to India, and at the same time, they're going at war with China, and India's our enemy, China's our friend. I mean, how, like, this is a new thing for them, right? This is a new thing for Pakistan. How do you think that this plays out? What do you think they do here?
Well, you're spot on. That's pretty much every pundit in Pakistan is saying that. Because not only just that, US has always treated Pakistan as a client state where they never really had decent investment in Pakistan, even in the Cold War era, when India opened up in the late 80s and early 90s, so US immediately, even though it was strategically more towards, obviously historically it was an ally of Soviet Union, but immediately when India also opened up, there was no investment that came into Pakistan, FDI, that went more so in India. But still, the relationship between US and India, they weren't warming up at that point. But eventually, with obviously the rise of China being, Pakistan being a close ally of China throughout this time, so it was just natural for Pakistan to rely more on China. And now China, there's a lot of foreign direct investment in Pakistan off China. It's quite clear that this century is going to be US versus China. Whoever's with China, you know, it's against the United States. And India is the only other major player who is ideologically more similar to or better suited to United States. It's, you know, it's on paper at least, but it is a secular state by and large. It is a world's largest democracy. It's thriving. There's a free market in there.
One of the fastest growing economies in the world.
Yeah, it has underperformed for a very long time. I mean, it's the same circumstances as China, but they just haven't been able to match that. But again, it's topped to be the second largest economy in the world by 2050, going past United States. It's just natural for United States to go with India. So yeah, I think that's everyone knows that, and these are the very simple dynamics of it. The problem with China and Pakistan is, or actually more so a problem for Pakistan, as we obviously know there's One Belt, One Road initiative. There's heavy investment in all, not only just Pakistan, but so many other countries as well. Pakistan is quite important with the Gwadar port, as it is, because China, through the South China Sea,
China does
get bottlenecked there. And the U.S. Navy in the Pacific, China always sees that as a threat. And all that Indian Ocean coastline as well, that can be clogged up there as well. So that it sees Gwadar as one of its own very crucial port that it can maintain in an event of a war. It can maintain that, but even, and that's why they're strategically placed and taken over Hambantota port in Sri Lanka as well. So there's a lot of things going on, but China, obviously, it's going to be very interesting in the years to come. But Pakistan definitely has lost its importance in the eyes of the United States.
You were a supporter of Imran Khan initially, right?
I still think it's better than the others, but it's not good enough though. He's been disappointment in so many things, but he's done some good things as well aspects. But yeah.
But what does he do? Like, for instance, like now he's got to have this alliance with China. We know that he does, right? Because the U.S. is going towards India, but China is also committing this genocide against Uyghur Muslims, and he has to stay quiet about that, even though he's like all the stuff against Ahmadis and. You know, he's talking about blasphemy and Islamophobia in the U.S., but he has to stay quiet about China, which is, and he just comes across blatantly as a hypocrite. But what does he do if he is caught in this sort of rocking hard?
This is above and beyond him. There was before him, Nawaz Sharif's party. I mean, that this One Belt, One Road initiative that was signed under them. So China and Pakistan, this is above and beyond any civilian government that comes in for a very long foreseeable future. At that level, that is actually decided by the Pakistani military. So whether Imran Khan stays or not, whether he speaks or not, it's irrelevant. And it's obviously he's not going to speak about Uyghur Muslims. He's been cornered by a couple of journalists a couple of times internationally. And he actually came up with a very good on-the-spot comment. He said, look, I mean, I know how China behaves. So, you know, he said that.
Wait. Do that again. Do the whole. Tell me exactly what he said, and just continue doing that. That's an incredible.
I don't know. I can do that in English, but I did pretty good in Urdu. But anyway, so he said, "Look, I know how China behaves. China is very different from the Western world. So China is very different from the Western world. He basically said, he said China because they're very introverted kind of society or civilization, so they like to be spoken in private if you want to criticize them, as if he would be sitting with Xi Jinping and saying, hey, by the way, you know, you should stop killing people in Xinjiang, as if he would be saying that. But that was a good rhetoric that he gave, and a lot I saw that narrative being used by a lot of Pakistani apologists that, oh, you know, like, yeah, we might be talking in private with them about it. But there's one hypocrisy, as far as hypocrisy goes, as I said, this is above and beyond Imran Khan. But hypocrisy that I noticed, that I was making one video regarding Pakistan's new plane, fighter jet. And so China is, okay, big, big country. And, you know, and Pakistan heavily relies on them. So it just sounds suicidal to go against them or speak against them. Because we know that how China observes all of these things. Even if you say something, you know, they can cut your diplomatic ties with you. But with Myanmar, right, with Rohingya Muslims, and that Myanmar has no significance, right?
Yeah.
Pakistan, you know, that fighter jet that Pakistan is so proud of producing by itself, the JF Thunder 17 or something that China helped them build, but they call it indigenously built. Fighter jet. So, you know, what are the three countries that Pakistan exports it to? I think four countries. Kenya, Malaysia, and Myanmar. Myanmar
is using it.
Myanmar military, they've given them 100, they've sold them 100 jets or something, and I think they're going to sell them a few more. All that while, but this Uyghur Muslim thing has been going on for well over a decade now, and everyone knows about it. But secretly, not even secretly, they're openly selling it to them. So you know, like, it's not about, at the end of the day, it's all about money.
Yeah, it is. It is. Armin, do you have any questions? Or
What are your thoughts on the future of secularism in Pakistan? And the future of both secular activists and atheist activists in Pakistan.
I think it's difficult to say that which way Pakistan will end up, but historically, if we just look at when these things happen, when significant portion of the society stand up on certain issue, governments end up either crumbling or going with them, and they end up evolving. So I do genuinely believe that every Muslim country that we've looked at, and you covered that one, Armin, with Iran, the Utrecht University, I think it was, that did the study. It is a mind-boggling statistic that 22% people claim to have no religion and 9% are atheists. So this is what, 31%. This is more than United States or UK, the number of agnostics and atheists in Iran. And then we see similar numbers in other countries like Tunisia is, I think, 35%. The people who call themselves non-religious, or I think Egypt, and there's so many other countries that's growing. Apparently Pakistan was 2% in 2012, but there was another survey done and they revised the figure to 1%. So that was a bit, and that was by Gallup. I don't know how big the study was, but it's a standard study that they do. Gallup does every 6 years or so. So that was a bit disappointing if you go by that, but I do believe that whatever the culture or the social system is in Pakistan, atheism is on the rise, or lack of religiosity is on the rise. So when that happens, that's going to happen everywhere. There will be atheists in, or non-religious people, or secularist people in the military, which is the hub of power in Pakistan. Some people say they already are. The elite already is non-religious, but for some reason they still use the clerics in Pakistan as an insurance policy against India.
Yeah. Well, I know for a fact that there are many, many people in the military in Pakistan who are out and out atheists.
Like, yeah, yeah,
out and out atheists. Yeah,
but because it's because the society is standing on hypocritical principles, and it's not clear with it. That's why you have some really hardcore mullahs in the military as well. So you have those kind of people as well. And obviously, there's a lot of video evidence as well, how that guy from TLP, the guy who you, Khadim Rizvi guy, his guys were given envelopes of cash in Faizabad Dharna in 2017, I think it was. So military was actually provoking or encouraging them to just go stand up against the then democratically elected Nawaz Sharif's government. So military still uses them for some reason. But eventually, as I said, overall, now we're seeing, I personally know four journalists who are atheists. I know a couple of politicians who are non-religious. Couple in Pakistan's, the Imran Khan's party as well. But again, they would never come out now. But what is to say that it's not going to happen when 20% of Pakistani population says we're agnostic, right? So I think it will change. By 2050, 2040, I think we're going to be living in a different Pakistan.
So the problem is that when demographics change in favor of either secularism or atheism, that doesn't always translate into the politics changing in that direction as well. Sometimes they are moving in the opposite direction. Like we see, sometimes it helps, but sometimes it actually doesn't, right? I mean, United States, people are becoming non-religious more and more, and then the Supreme Court judges became more and more conservative. And Israel is going the wrong direction. Politics was going the wrong direction, even though the demographics was becoming more atheist and more secular. We have many Arab countries, even in Malaysia, Indonesia. So, but the interesting thing about Pakistan is that unlike countries like, I don't know, Iran or Saudi Arabia, it's not necessarily the government that is between the people and these political shifts happening, right? If you compare like Pakistan to a country like Iran, where the people want secularism and the government doesn't, but then you look at Pakistan, it's that there are these mobs or these mullahs, and they, even if they are a fraction, I mean, they're big, I mean, but there are many of them, but they're still not the majority, but they still manage to have a huge influence on. They're just a lot more willing to take risk, willing to do things that other people are not able, willing to threaten, willing to use violence, and they intimidate not just other people, but also the government. If you want to compare Pakistan to Iran, where most of the problem from in Iran is coming from the government, but in Pakistan it's coming from these mobs, from these groups of people, does that make it an easier problem to deal with at some point, or is it more difficult? How do you compare them, and what do you think the impact on, you know, the progress is going to be in the future?
Well, I think it is. I would call it an easier problem. Obviously, in case of Iran, as you're 100% right. So the government is more theocratic, while people are more secularist, and it's just only a matter of time when the Islamic Republic of Iran will fall, and you know some other form of government would be applied. I mean, it's a matter of time. I mean,
I'm not so sure about that, but okay.
Okay. Well, look. I mean, there's been two attempts since 2009, and obviously they were brutally crushed. So, I don't know, like how these 30% become 50%. What's going to happen then? And people are going. So we don't know. You're right. I mean, but at least if there is to happen, then that would be. That might be the only way to happen, where there has to be another revolution. Whereas in Pakistan, it can gradually evolve. And you're right that Pakistani government, again, is a very, and that's what people say, and I never paid much attention to it. That, you know, it's like they have this identity crisis, and we're constantly, and because I personally don't buy into this. I mean, I don't care who my ancestors were or what they believed in. I don't care. But for some reason, people do. And this is why Pakistani textbooks keep changing over time. So sometimes we come from Arabs, sometimes we come from Turks, sometimes we try to import Turkish culture. Sometimes, by the way, we never import Iranian culture for some reason because it's Shias. I think that's probably why.
But what are you talking about? Your national anthem is in Persian.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's the only thing that is in Persian. Actually, our language is quite.
No. Our big poet is
Farsi. So language.
Mirza Ghalib wrote the majority of his poetry in Farsi, right?
Yeah, I think Farsi language is the one, but in terms of the actual heroes that they import, they're either Afghans or Turks or Arabs. So I'm saying that being charitable, because I think Pakistan government itself doesn't want to be a hardliner, because there's still some remnants of the Anglo-Saxon British rise that we had. Pre-1947, and the founder of Pakistan wasn't a hardline Islamist either. So that's probably why they haven't gone towards Islamism yet as much, but they still aspire to some extent, and they send these mixed messages to down to the local public, and that's why the public demands more and more, because people obviously think that, well, once you import Islam, apply Sharia, everything will be fine. But then even public is confused, because when it comes to voting people, they don't vote for the Islamist parties. They vote for these, you know, these moderate parties. I mean, it shouldn't even be calling them Islamist parties.
I think that is a good... So it's really hard to find a way to measure this stuff. So you talked about the Gallup poll. You talked about... you remember, like, just a couple of years ago, they were cracking down and lifting up, like, these... sort of Bessa and all these other sort of activists. There was a Hang Ayaz Nizami thing that was trending there. Everybody was calling for his execution. So they were cracking down on it, and they're cracking down on it, frankly, because it was a threat. So they were cracking down on Facebook posts. I know that I've gotten loads of messages from Twitter saying that, you know, Pakistan has asked to remove this tweet or that tweet. I know that you get loads of those too. They've been cracking down. And Kumar Khuldoon Shahid, who's a journalist in Pakistan, he did a report in The Diplomat on this, about the atheists in Pakistan, how they're communicating. So initially they had the Pakistani atheist agnostic groups on Facebook and things like that. All of that, you know, the government cracked down on. And then they eventually went to these private messaging services like WhatsApp. And everybody's kind of scared of that too now. So now they're moving the Signal and some of these other
Telegram and yeah.
Yeah. So everything is very, very, very covert right now. It's a very difficult thing to get a reading on. You know, you do see, as you said, when you look at the elections, and people still are not voting in large numbers for these Islamist parties, even though everybody goes out and professes their love for them, shows up at, you know, Khadim Rizvi's funeral in huge, massive numbers. Like they do all of that, but you just don't see it. I mean, they don't. So for some reason, when it comes to going into the voting booth and figuring out whether you want this to be a part of your daily life and your politics, that's not what they choose. So it's kind of,
and I think that's,
it's a hard thing for me, like in terms of
put a finger on. No, but yeah. but that's because, but yeah, but that, and this is why I said it's a good problem to have, because it might be easy. It doesn't require a bloody revolution for. But I think the reason for that is it's not only hard for us to read. I think it's hard for the Pakistani government and the establishment to figure it out as well, because they can't draw the line either. So they have to. They parroted this blasphemy, anti-blasphemy narrative. But they have never executed anyone under blasphemy because they know that this is bullshit.
That's right.
It's embarrassing for them. And there will be international pressure on them. And, you know, but we all know what happened with Asia Bibi. By the way, I don't know if you're aware, there's another incident that happened last month. Another Christian nurse, yeah. Abita Gill, brutally beaten up by her fellow nurses. And now police, obviously, first police refused to register the case.
For singing for a patient a Christian song?
And it wasn't a song. Say she was saying that the pray to Jesus for help or something like that. Mm-hmm. We never know what the exact truth is. Some people, so whatever. So yeah, I think that's probably more likely. It's very similar to what the common belief is. But the police initially didn't, and I've been told the police actually want to stay out of this. But they get intimidated by these mobs of angry people. They surround. They initially refused to register a case of blasphemy under her, on her, and then nearly 2,000 people surrounded the police station, and they said, "Okay, well now we're gonna arrest her and charge her with blasphemy." They did, and then they put her in protective custody or whatever, which is solitary confinement. Now you know the case. Now she's gone. She's gone for another 10 years. The case will linger on for 2 years in the lower court, and then it'll go to a higher court, and then it'll go to Supreme Court. The lower courts are going to sentence her to death, just like it happens in every other case. And then the Supreme Court will say not enough evidence. But unfortunately, 10 years will pass, and this poor woman is going to suffer a lot just for simply what Armin said. So my point is that because the government itself is confused, they throw out this narrative that, oh, you know, and it's good that a lot of people are becoming. I was interviewed yesterday by this YouTuber, very educated, he's a Pakistani in Canada. He asked the same thing to me. He said, "Well, Harris, I mean, a lot of people are drawn to your videos. They like it." He said he watched a lot of my videos for research purposes. But he said, "I said, oh, you know, Rasulullah bungi marte, you know, like what I said, well, Prophet Muhammad talks crap in Urdu." So he said, "What, did you have to use that word? Because, you know, that would," I said, "Well, no, this is why it's so important, because the narrative of blasphemy has been so popularized in Pakistan that now they just passed a legislation a few months ago. They said, now you have in addition to Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, you have to say Khatmul Nabiyin before you say his name, meaning the final prophet, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. You have to say that. If you don't say that, that could be regarded as blasphemy." So I said, this is why it's important for us to humanize Muhammad. We have to talk, we have to bring Muhammad, for lower him from that holy cow status, and then treat him like an ordinary people. I said, this is why we use it that way.
I know this is not accurate, but it seems sometimes that in Pakistan, it's more sensitive to these mullahs for people. The idea of that some people believe that Muhammad is a prophet, but he's not the last prophet, triggers them a lot more than people who don't even think Muhammad is a prophet.
Because of Ahmadis.
It's the Ahmadi aspect, right? That's why they want to say Khatam and the Nabuin and all that stuff, because, you know,
But is it like if you let's say you're not even an Ahmadi or anything, but if you're like, I believe in the Quran, I believe in Prophet Muhammad, I think he was a prophet, not the last prophet, but a prophet, I think like you're gonna get like people are gonna pull out their hair and try to like murder you more than you say, like, no, I'm not even a Muslim, right? Like,
yeah.
I don't know. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right, and I think and it is because of Ahmadi aspect, because then they immediately think that you're an Ahmadi because you're the follower of Mirza Ghulam Ahmad. But by the way, something similar could have happened to Iran as well, But Iran, with Baha'i faith, they said, well, we're not even Muslims anymore. So which could have been very similar if he had insisted that, okay, Baha'i is an extension of Islam. And this is the final
problem. Well, Baha'is are easier for a lot of Iranians to attack because of their connections to Israel and mm-hmm. having their temple in Haifa and the close relationship. So that is like really like a lot of conspiracy theories.
But didn't that start as I can't remember, but I remember reading that in that book. But didn't that start as some sort of a feminist movement? It was the Princess Greta Lane or something.
Well, no, it didn't start like that. But there was this one woman, very at the beginning, who became very very popular, and she was
was killed.
She had like, her job off, and she was jailed, and yeah, and all of that. It's like. But I mean, yeah, this is stuff that we had to like. We were never told about any of this, by the way, growing up. This was like something I learned after I left Iran. But yeah,
wasn't she the daughter of the founder of the Baha'i faith? I can't remember. I think her name was Quratulain. Was that Quratulain?
Yeah. And she has a nickname. Now you're putting me on the spot. She has
probably Annie.
No,
Quratulain. Usually, people named Quratulain, their nickname is Annie.
Because I remember because that was. I think she was one of the first women who took off the hijab, and that so the source that I was reading at, and they
was
gave
preaching
it
the without the hijab, which is pretty
yes
crazy,
exactly. Right? So she was so you know she with the iconic photo that we have now, that where this woman stands up with a hijab on a stick. So you know, yeah. So someone was actually comparing that with her, that okay, she was the original one. And she paid a heavy price. But going back to Pakistan, because yeah, you're right. With this, the final prophet, that's the main issue with Pakistan. They're stuck on that, and that is considered a blasphemy as well. So government is confused. They can't decide how far they need to go. But because once you parrot the narrative, it becomes ordinary people are going to take it to the next level. And they see it's a virtuous thing to do. If they see that someone is a blasphemer, those women who were beating up this fellow nurse who happened to be a Christian, they were saying, well, we don't care about going to prison. We don't care about losing our jobs. She insulted our prophet when she hadn't. All she had was like she was doing pretty much what every Muslim does. She was saying, pray to Jesus for help.
As much as all this stuff happens, and you're right, like nobody's actually ever properly been executed for blasphemy, but the people who took that law into their own hands, like Mumtaz Qadri, you know, they've been celebrated and venerated, and there have been, you know, he murdered the governor of Punjab because he thought he was a blasphemer, showing solidarity with Asia Bibi and so on. So we all know that story. He celebrated. And the other thing is, so there's that, okay? And he was executed, you know, credit to the government there. But there's this acquittal, right, of that Sheikh, what's his name, Omar Sheikh, like
Omar Sheikh, yeah,
Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal journalist, and they beheaded that. That's actually the first video I saw. Someone sent it to me. This was
like, me. I saw that was the first video as well when I first time saw it. I was like,
Facebook and before everything. And since then, I've never watched one of those videos because that
exactly
for days. Okay, yeah. Because one of my journalist friends sent it to me, and he's like, well, I think it's very important for everybody to watch it. And after I was like, no, you know what?
I was traumatized as well when I saw it.
Yeah. So and they acquitted this guy. And you saw the video. I saw the video. They acquitted this guy.
But he wasn't recognizable in the video, though.
He was convinced. Everybody knew it was him. Like it was him, right?
I mean, the U.S. believed it was him. Yeah. Look, I mean, it's more likely it was him. I can't.
So is that why they acquitted him? Because I still can't figure out why he was acquitted. Was there this?
There was a technical problem in the prosecution. So some people now believe that you obviously know the Thana culture in Pakistan. They're not your detectives who get the degrees from, you know, in crime and law degree. They don't get that. They're just a local thanedar who becomes a detective, and so they have no regard for the actual they have no proper system of gathering information and collecting evidence, etc. So they apparently what happened was they were saying that the initial statement that Omar Sheikh had given had not corroborated with the actual statement that was put in by the prosecution in the, submitted as evidence. So there were some contradictions in that statement. And then I think Omar Sheikh had also later on reneged his confession and said it was taken under duress. There were all these technical problems that they had collected. And when it went to Supreme Court, they said, well, sorry, the evidence is faulty. And Supreme Court is not wrong there. So what people say now, because and this is why prosecution is usually blamed, and this is one of the lowest conviction rate in any matter, whether that's robbery, murder, or the R word, any of that is one of the lowest in the world, or I think definitely one of the lowest in Asia, because the constitution is very Anglo-Saxon based, where the legal system is very Anglo-Saxon, but the practices are very... they're very shanty. So people say that they deliberately sabotage this their own investigation, deliberately create these contradictions in their own investigation. So when it goes to Supreme Court, that they can just manipulate that, and then they can throw it out on technical grounds. So that's what happened. But the good thing is that the government is actually under the pump. I think it was the first week of Biden administration, and I don't even know the names of the most.
I don't think the Biden administration. I think that was the most severely they've ever criticized another country.
Yeah, well, it was in the first week. I mean, the White House spokesperson or chief of staff, White House chief of staff. I think he gave out a statement. Attorney General, I think, gave out a statement, and they said, "Well, they must not be let out of Pakistan." So they have been put in the exit control list, so they cannot go. And they actually hinted that United States is ready to accept them. So I don't know if they will be handed over to Pakistan, but apparently they are under close guard. But yeah, I think now it's just a matter of putting political pressure. But it's a travesty of justice.
Yeah, it's Armin.
Oh no! I do want to ask Bulbul's question before it scrolls all the way up. Is that okay?
Bulbul means dove, by the way.
Yeah, it does. Bulbul is asking: Kamala Harris has expressed support for Kashmiri self-determination, and her niece has criticized Hindu nationalism. How do you see this playing out in India-U.S.-Pakistani relations? So,
yeah, well, that's an interesting Indian one. Background.
Yeah, she's an Indian background. She's got a Hindu background. And she is anti-Hindutva. That's not a surprise.
That's not a surprise. And this is the reason why a lot of Hindutva people hated her even before. That they were going for Trump. I was like, when I first saw Kamala Harris, a lot of Pakistanis, there was a real time shivers down their spine when they realized Kamala Harris has got Indian roots. Because a lot of Pakistanis were jealous, angry. They're like, oh, shit, now there's an Indian going to be in the White House. how hard Desi people think, and they were like, "Oh," but then as we worked out, she's a far leftist, and she's woke, wokistani basically. So we realized that Indians started, not Indians, Hindu nationalists started hating her, and Pakistanis started loving her, and I think it's just her niece has criticized Hindu nationalism. I don't think anyone would ignore Hindu nationalism. We all criticize Hindu nationalism. Kashmiri self-determination is going a bit too far, coming from in any official capacity, I think. My opinion has actually evolved on that. I mean, I used to oversimplify as well. And I said, well, let people do whatever they want. If they want to be separated from a union or a federation, give them a right to do so. But I think it's a little bit more complex than that. By the way, and I recently found out in the United States, when Texas and all these other states became a part of the United States in the 19th century, they actually signed, I don't know, it doesn't matter eventually, but they said under no circumstances you would ever be able to separate from the United States of America. So, which is fine. I mean, no country becomes a country with the intention that, okay, but
a lot of people are regretting that when it comes to Texas. But anyway,
it's very, very small.
By the way, the live chat is pointing out that Kamala Harris is not really woke. Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, no, she's not. She's a liberal sort of left person.
I mean, yeah,
Enough. I mean, I would say only, I think I would definitely say Biden is a classical liberal. He's even a God-believing liberal. But Kamala Harris, I don't know. I think that lady scares me.
Really? I think they're both kind of on the same page. I don't think it's. I mean, she has pronouns in her bio and stuff. I mean, if you think
like, that's fine,
people speak out about that. I don't think that I've never thought that was such a big deal. But in any case, so there's that question. I think that and so I want to ask you about Biden as well. Okay, so we had this conversation, Armin and I. Last couple of times we did the episodes, we were talking about how, you know, the pressure that they put on the Saudis actually worked because the Saudis are vulnerable to U.S. leverage right now. They're kind of not in a good position. So, you know, they paused the arms sales to Saudi Arabia. They have he's withdrawn support for the Saudi war in Yemen. And, you know, Lujain al-Hathloum, he's out of place.
Yeah.
Right.
Not his latest comments on China wasn't good, though.
Yeah, I'm sure. I think that the China thing he's navigating in all kinds of different ways. But and then you have this pressure on Pakistan about this. You know, like you're saying, it's actually working. The U.S. pressure when it comes to Daniel Pearl's killers. How do you think this bodes for the future of the whole Biden administration?
I think it'll be business as usual, though. I think in terms of Pakistan, it's not going to make much difference. I think in a Daniel Pearl thing, this is a very low level thing on a larger scale. Again, because Pakistan, United States doesn't have any leverage in Pakistan because there's never been any trade, foreign direct investment. The only relationship they've had is obviously United States being the superpower. Pull they have is through economic sanctions, and you know that's the only thing they've used in the past against Pakistan as well in the 90s. With the nuclear crisis and all that, so I don't think that Pakistan would be guilty enough that any economic sanctions will be coming on Pakistan. But other than that, United States got nothing on Pakistan. United States would also be worried about how much they would isolate Pakistan and it would go further towards China. So all these things play out. So this is why I think it's definitely going to be business as usual. There's not going to be anything. Pakistan will be in the middle. Pakistan will be playing United States as well. And they also, with another aspect is, you know, that they wanted to get out of Afghanistan. So that they cannot do that without the support of Pakistan. So Pakistan knows they have, you know, Pakistan's keeping the cards very close to their chest. So that might be one of the reasons why they actually let go of Omar Sheikh to poke and prod the incoming Biden administration, see what happens. Because Biden, again, is a more responsible politician. He's a career politician. It's not like Trump, who in a fit of rage would, you know, pick up
tweet out, and,
tweet out. So, yeah. So I don't think... So, you know, Saudi Arabia is a different case because it's in the middle of a war. Saudi Arabia is heavily dependent on United States, so they can twist their arm a little bit more. But in case of Pakistan, I think it's going to be different. The only way they can actually poke Pakistan is by going further towards India. For example, you know, going further in the nuclear deal with India. So that's the only way. But even if Pakistan hadn't released this Omar Sheikh guy or hasn't been antagonizing United States on a smaller scale, United States, as I said, it's natural for United States to go.
Well, I mean, another leveraging thing is the U.S. gets closer to India. You know, Pakistan could, because, you know, one of the reasons the U.S. used to give all the money to Pakistan is not because they wanted Pakistan 100% on their side. They just didn't want them to go over to China, right? I mean, that's also another thing. There's still a little bit of a strategic interest.
Yeah.
Where, like you said, you know, with the Afghanistan withdrawal and everything. So, you know, are they... So there is this the provocation thing, that one of the leverage things that Pakistan does have is that, okay, I'm going to go with China. And the U.S. would rather have Pakistan 50% on its side than 100% on China's side. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. Armin.
Can you ask this question?
Okay. So question from Shuvo Das. Do you think that in the future, Pakistani government can separate itself from its military? Since its inception, Pakistan acted like a military with a country rather than the opposite. When was the first peaceful transition of power from civilian to civilian? It was actually quite recent. It was
This is the first time.
That's a very good way of phrasing it, by the way. I never thought about it like that. That's pretty interesting.
This is a very common saying that Pakistan, other countries have militaries, but Pakistan military has a country. Pakistan, you know.
It's like Egypt. It's actually the closest thing to Pakistan. Like
Turkey was very similar to that as well.
Turkey was similar to it, but Egypt especially. I mean, you know, you had the democratic forces, but the army was always there.
Yeah, some people claim that it's becoming like that with the IRGC in Iran, but not even close to what it's like in Pakistan.
So in Pakistan, this is the first time in its history that the democratic government finished its 5 years, even though the prime ministers were within the party, they were overthrown for corruption allegations. But the parliament ran through its 5 years. And then another government came in for 5 years. And now this is a third transition. So this is the first time in Pakistan's 72-year history. And hopefully this trend will continue. But it is at a very delicate balance. But people have realized. I mean, now with hindsight, I think maybe this is what they meant by evolution or let the democracy flourish and mature. Because Pakistan has tried this yo-yo between military and civilian and the civilian and military all the time. And sometimes, you know, I think maybe 5 years might have played a part because it's too long. And people who, you know, like imagine how much people hated Trump. When Trump was in power, like, I mean, people, the people on the other side, they would do anything. They would have even supported a military overthrow of Trump. They would have. So this is what happens in Pakistan as well, because they're like, they hate the other party so much that they'd be like, yep. And in the past, late Benazir Bhutto, she was complicit in going to the army generals and saying, well, you know, overthrow the Nawazshif government. And when she came to power, then they were guilty of going to the military as well. So they had been doing that, but now they're all assured that now we would never do that, or none of the parties will ever do that, because they probably have gone through this maturity process. So I think that, just to answer the question, I think this is why I had faith or belief in Imran Khan that he might be okay, because in his case, there is no allegation of corruption, but there's a lot of allegations of incompetence in this case. So the good thing is, even though the other opposition parties hate him, but they're not going to the military to have him overthrown, probably because they think the military is on their side on his side anyway. But I think this next transition of government would be very important. And I think once we have a whole generation of people who have lived through this democratic transition, then I think it will become harder and harder for the military to come back. And at that point, I think military would become less and less influential.
So a lot of there's this understanding that it's not that the military is not becoming less influential. And this is not just Pakistan. This is I don't know if it's a philosophy or it's a conspiracy. It's from one country to another, people's understanding is how good the military is in trying to put on a show that looks like a democracy so that it's able to act like a civilized country with the rest of the world. But at the end of the day, it is just the military, and there's this illusion of people having a choice. But if people make the wrong choice, then there's like the people who have the gun always have the option to do a coup, right? Like, I mean, we saw this in Myanmar just recently, right? People are like, hey, let's have democracy so that the world doesn't sanction us and that deals with us. And they're like, oh, oopsies, you guys chose wrong. These accusations also exist in Iran. Some people even make these, and this is where it gets to conspiracy. They make these accusations even for countries like the United States. Sometimes, like, you can see that the conspiracy doesn't work in a country like Turkey, like where there was an attempt by the military to do a coup and it didn't work. So this play between like a real democracy or a democracy that is just like a show by the military, it exists in almost in every country. I guess like when it comes to Myanmar or Pakistan, it's very heavily on like the show is nobody's buying the show. Like, what do you think?
No, I think Myanmar is where Pakistan was in the 90s. So we all know at that point, military was controlling that, even though military was allowing, they always had the option of, they always had the stick in their hand and they could always barge in whenever they wanted. They still technically can, but they know that it creates a mess now. As I said, that's the whole process of evolution maturity. So I don't think that military would want to do anything, even though they still have the power. But this is why the next transition would be very important. That would be fourth transition to power, democratic by democratic means. That would, with every transition, the influence of the military grows weaker on a potential coup. You also got to remember one thing, that these military generals, Pakistan military is actually a very highly sophisticated and organized institute, because there is no general for life in Pakistan. They actually change after every 3 years. I know the last couple of years they've been, and this might be the reason, the last two generals, they were given extension, 3 year extension, which is against the constitution, which was against the constitution, but they passed it under the thumb of the government military to allow that. But again, so there can't be any individual's authority in the military either. So it's still an institutional supremacy. For example, you know, like you have a supreme leader in Iran who is the supreme leader for life. I think it's the same case in Myanmar as well. The generals have been in power for so long. I mean, the guy at the top. So that doesn't happen in Pakistan. So that's why the good thing about that is that with the new general comes a new mentality, a new thinking process. So it's not necessarily going to inherit the same point of view as the previous one. And this was one of the reasons why Pervez Musharraf was actually eventually ousted by the democratic powers, because he was being, as well as the president of Pakistan, he was being the head of the military as well, for as long as he could. But the moment he stepped down from the military position, he was ousted. So I don't think that Pakistan is where Myanmar is, and it still is the democracy, you could call it. It's not 100% democracy. The power is still in the military's hand. But I think with each transition, it's getting strengthened.
Just to add something to this very quickly, even in like Iran with the supreme leader, there is a debate on whether or not the supreme leader gets to remain the supreme leader if it loses the support of IRGC. So there's that debate as well there. I don't know if we're going to have time to do. I was interested in asking you about the future of relationships between Pakistan and India, like what are your predictions on that? And also maybe like see if you ever see at any point normalization. I think I know the answer to this one, but I wanted to ask you, between Pakistan and Israel, the way that we saw like some other Gulf Arab countries and Sudan and other countries are getting close to Israel. Go on, Ali.
No, I was going to ask for that. So I'm going to actually, I second that question, and I want to add something else to it, that like this, something, I think the Biden team has moved Israel from its Europe. Like, you know, they have these teams that work on, you know, the foreign policy, from the Europe thing to the same area as, you know, Pakistan, everything else. I can't remember the details of it, sorry. But since they formed these relationships and alliances with the Arab nations. Is that something that is going to also affect Pakistan? Because, you know, you've got Israel and India.
Not sure. I don't think so. Again, Pakistan has this very outside. It's a very weird policy on Israel. And actually, there was a bit of a debate going on in Pakistan covertly about 4 or 5 months ago. One of the journalists, I don't know, I think we spoke about this or not, but one of the journalists even gave an interview to Israeli journalists where they were just, a lot of people said they were, one of the mainstream Pakistani journalists. So he was saying whether they're testing waters because, you know, like it was in the news, UAE has now accepted, recognized Israel, and Saudi Arabia is going to, and Saudi Arabia, and Imran Khan actually on record said that we are being pressured by some Muslim brother countries to recognize Israel as well. But I will never do that.
He was probably just saying that just to see what the reaction is going to be.
Exactly.
Right?
Because one of very pro Imran Khan journalists, Mubashir Lukman, actually did this interview, a very candid, very cool, friendly interview with the Israeli journalist But again, it's a lot of people in Pakistan, there's a debate raging on in Pakistan. Like, I mean, the Arabs, they have the main problem. They're this. But then what do you, but again, this is what happened with Pakistan, with this anti-blasphemy narrative, this anti-Israel narrative that they built over 75 years. They now, even if the government would want to do something, they can't, because they've just dogmatized their own people so much. Pakistan is more likely to have friendly relationships with India than with Israel.
Yes.
And they have no connection with Israel whatsoever. They've never been in direct conflict or anything.
Just to clarify something, because some people might think we're being naive. When we say, like, he's doing it to see what the reaction is going to be, like, yes, we're not saying if he's going to see the reaction is negative or positive. Yes, we know that he knows, and everybody else knows. How, like, yes, we're like, he was trying to see how big the backlash is going to be. Of course, it was the reaction was going to be negative. Go on, Ali, sorry.
Yeah, so I wanted to go back to what Armin said. I think it is important. We've got a minute left, you know, maybe, but predictions for the future in terms of how it's going to play out with India. What is Pakistan going to do with India? I mean, there's a world of difference between these two countries in every way, economically, in terms of growth, and just everything.
Technically, Pakistan shouldn't even be, it's not even a real country, though. It's India hijacked by Islamists, right?
it might be technically true, but I don't buy that argument. But apparently, I never used to buy this argument, but apparently this confusion in Pakistani textbook and Pakistani intelligentsia, this keeps showing me that maybe it is a very important part, that if we don't recognize India as our civilization. And one of the, I don't know, Ali, if you heard it, because recently just Pakistan passed a law that in Islamabad, the, you know, Arabic would become mandatory.
Yeah, every kid,
yeah. And one of the senators from Pakistan People's Party, Benazir Bhutto's party, so he said that my civilization is not Arab. My civilization is the Indus civilization, which is the Indic civilization. So, but I'm like, I mean, does that even matter? Like, is it really that important? But apparently it is. Apparently we have to decide who is our spiritual or intellectual or civilizational father, whether these are the Indics, which is not us. Oh, you know, we can't be called Indic. Or they are Arabs or they're Turks.
There has to be. Armin. So wait, hold on. Bulbul is saying Armin is now supporting Akhand Bharat.
Akhand Bharat means United India.
Yeah. So wait. I have to say this, because Armin brought this up about in Iran, what they're doing is, because they're seeing a lot of these kids are moving away from religion, right? They're bringing a nationalism aspect, a nationalism conversation, our Zoroastrian heritage, our Persian Empire heritage, whatever it is. That stuff is coming in to help unite people. Now, in Pakistan, you know that it's fragmented. Okay, you've got the Punjabis, you've got the Balochis, you've got the Sindhis, you know, the Mohajers, and the Pathans, and, you know, Pashtun. You have all of these different ethnicities. They all speak different languages. They don't necessarily like each other. They're very disjointed. The only thing that holds them all together is Islam.
Islam.
Right? Islam is the one thing. The religion held everything together. So now, as Islam dissipates, and as this youth grows up, and they're being exposed to all these ideas on the internet and everything, they're like, okay, the religion thing goes away. What is the glue that's going to hold everybody together?
I genuinely believe
where the civilizational history is important. That's why I think they're exploring different things.
And I think, obviously, as this religiosity or Islamism exited my being, I also realized, you know, like, I became more and more sympathetic and open towards India as a country and civilization. Like, I mean, I removed all those natural biases that I had. Like, you know, like, I mean, yeah, we were Pakistani. We used to hate India, right? We had to, otherwise we're not Pakistanis, which is ingrained in that. But as Islam kept leaving me, I mean, I kept becoming more pro-India and well-wisher of India, and actually not feeling jealous when India put a rover in the moon on the moon, and you know, I feel great about it. So I think eventually you're right. When as Islamism weakens or Islam weakens in Pakistan, who knows? I mean, 100 years later, this all might be United India. Who knows?
Is it fair
to say that a weaker Islam in Pakistan means a weaker Hindutva in India?
Yeah, well, eventually it will.
I mean, think,
look,
I feel the Hindu extremism in India, it was a reaction to Pakistan and Islam as the enemy. So, I mean,
it's like Trumpism and wokeness, right?
I mean, we're so anti-Islam. We have to blame everything on Islam at the end of the day. That's just in our nature. So.
No, but it is true. But it is true. But again, when people get this taste of blood in their mouth, then you know, people forget this as well. That back in the day, why the need for Pakistan arised as well. The founder of Pakistan was pro United India, but he also used this argument because there was Hindutva movement then as well. There were Hindus at that time as well who were killing Muslims for eating beef. They were throwing pigs in front of mosques. So there were Hindutva people then as well, and which is why. The founder of Pakistan, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, decided that, okay, well, you know what, these guys, we can't live together, so we got to create a separate country. So, yes. So, I mean, it's not that simplistic either. So, that's why religion...
I think that's part of the history.
So, religion entirely has to go, but I do think that Hinduism is likely to dissipate or at least lose its power or influence if there is a weaker Islam. So it has to happen together simultaneously, but who knows? I mean, I'm a big believer. The borders are always changing. So every civilization thought that, you know, they're there for eternity, forever. But you know, right. Rome for after 1,000 years ended up falling. And so with these maps will also change. These borders will change again.
Yeah,
1,000 years is technically forever when it comes to history. But anyways, we're about can we promote Harris Sultan's channel?
Yeah, we're going to right now. So just you know, the Lahore. By the way, I know like my parents actually immigrated to Lahore from India, right? Uh-huh. So my parents were both born in India. So I'm technically Indian Pakistani. But
you're Hindustani,
huh?
Are you the one they call Hindustani?
Who migrated to
the people who migrated to Pakistan after Pakistan's creation in 1948.
My mother's family came in 1950 to Lahore. My father's family migrated in 1947 to Karachi.
Okay, guys, before we actually end this, I'm gonna Shuvo is saying, can we end this on a positive note? So to be able to end this on a positive note, Harris, what would you say to people who look at Pakistan and all the bad news that constantly comes out of there and think like, you know what, this seems like this is a failed state, there's no hope, this is crap, let's give up on Pakistan. What would you say to that?
I would say they're obviously very shallow-minded and simplistic people. I mean, I have on purpose started a new playlist where I have decided that I'm going to show the good sides of Pakistan as well, because it's very important to show that, because we also end up creating an echo chamber, you know, like my own people who listen to me and they say, oh, Harris, you know, like, I mean, I'm interested in what Harris has to say, but they become very bitter towards Pakistan as well. So it's very important that we show Pakistan is a country, complex country. I've said it many times. People of Pakistan are wonderful people. If any Westerner went to Pakistan, they would be treated like kings and queens. You would go to the shops, they wouldn't even charge you. They would be so happy.
The music,
and food as well. But they would treat you very well. Albeit that you don't talk about Islam, which is fair enough. It's not fair enough, but it is what it is. But so there are some trigger points, there's some weak points. So please don't judge Pakistan the whole way. And this is why I say that I still I am a Pakistani. I was born in Pakistan. Even if Pakistan disintegrates, I would still call myself a Pakistani, because you know, like people who were born in Yugoslavia, mm-hmm. they say, well, I was born in Yugoslavia. So that can never go away in my lifetime. And I don't want Pakistan to disintegrate. I want Pakistan to become a good, vibrant 21st century country, modernize itself, become a secular country, and people become, you know, valuable people. So Pakistan is capable of doing all that. It's a very big, major country, 220 million population. By the way, I learned that yesterday, out of all Stan countries, if they're all united, it will be called Stanistan, and Pakistan will be the powerhouse of that.
There was an attempt at some point.
No, really? But because
I don't know. With the North, okay.
No, anyway, so Pakistan can be a very, it is, there's a lot of good in Pakistan as well, the music and the food and so many things. So don't give up. I wouldn't give up on Pakistan.
Messaging-wise, I think that if we go with this whole idea that we're anti-Islam because we're pro-Pakistan, If we start
I want Pakistan to get better. And in my opinion, the only way for Pakistan to get better is to get rid of the virus of Islam.
As Noam Chomsky said. Okay, so we're going to wrap it up here. Haris Sultan and we're going to talk about, let's talk about where people can find you. You've got an Urdu channel called Pakistani Mohammed still, right?
Yeah, I do have quite a few channels, but for English speaking audience, I would just say I'm 49,100 subscribers now, so I'm hoping to cross 50,000 subscribers on my channel, Haris Sultan. So do follow me on that. But if you do speak Urdu and Hindi, you can look up Pakistani Mulhid. Mulhid means an atheist, so you can follow me on that. I do one stream in Urdu every week, and I do one stream in English every week. And I talk about all things India, Pakistan related, some stories, some funny stories, some embarrassing stories. I'm usually a bit more funnier than this as well.
And so, dinosaurs. And you talk about dinosaurs.
There was only one episode of dinosaurs, and I'm gonna invite more paleontologists as well.
That's good. I love paleontologists. They're amazing. Yeah. Haris Sultan, born in Lahore like me. What hospital were you born in?
I think Gangaram Hospital.
Oh, that's where my youngest brother was born, Jameer. And I was born in Lady Wellington. I was a lot older. Circumcised in Lahore, too? You were also circumcised, right?
Yes, yes.
That's great.
Yes.
Oh, by the way, what do you call the cheap circumcision? A ripoff. Okay, just remember that. I'm going to close on that. Guys,
check out Haris Sultan on YouTube. Go support his channel, especially if you're interested in Islam, secular activism, atheism, Pakistan. And, India. You know, I'm not like, yeah. Okay. So like when I say dinosaurs, I'm not making fun of it. Like it's very good that he's promoting like a love for, like Haris is also passionate about science, and showing that passion to his audience is also very, very helpful. So I do appreciate that. Go check out his channel, go support his channel, and we're good.
Yeah. Go to patreon.com/SJME. Consider becoming a patron if you like what you hear. Okay. Right. This is if you're hearing the audio version. If you want links to Haris's stuff and everything else that we do, go to YouTube and you can find this over there and you'll find all the links. For as little as a dollar, you can become a patron. You can watch all of these things live, 5 episodes every month, and join in and ask questions and conversations, and interact with us and everything like that.
And too. You can become my patron as well, and you can get my book as well.
Yes, and Haris Sultan is also, he's also the author of The Curse of God. There's so much stuff. All of the links are in the description. I'm going to put them all in there. But everybody, be best, enjoy yourselves,
be best.
And we'll talk to you guys next time. Thank you, Haris.
Thank you. The secular jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends. Write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions. Or head over to secularjihadist.com and give a dollar or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air and more. Till next time, may the flying spaghetti monster be with you.